Senator Angus King, home for the Thanksgiving holiday, answers your questions about the important issues of the day. On cable television yesterday, U.S. Senator Angus King said he is guardedly optimistic about the new agreement on Iran's nuclear program. King serves on the Senate Intelligence Committee, where not only Iran, but also Syria and Afghanistan remain on the front burner. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll discuss Senator King's views on foreign relations, as well as other topics, including his vote to change the Senate's filibuster rule, partisan politics on Capitol Hill, and the National Defense Authorization Act. Of course, we want to hear from you. What issues are you following? What are your biggest concerns about Congress? What would you like to ask Senator Angus King? It's Maine Calling on MPBN, but first, the news. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Last night, President Obama announced what some called an historic agreement with Iran to address that nation's disputed nuclear program. Last week, Senate Democrats changed the filibuster rules, which affect executive branch and most judicial branch nominees. The timer is ticking on House and Senate negotiators to reach a budget deal before a January 15th deadline. If a deal isn't reached, another possible government shutdown looms. Our guest today is in the middle of most of the news coming out of Washington. Senator Angus King is Maine's junior senator. He serves on the Senate Rules Committee, the Intelligence and Armed Services Committee, and the Budget Committee. He's with me in the studio to share his thoughts on the latest news out of Washington and to answer your comments and questions. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can also send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Senator King, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Welcome, Jennifer. You listed off those issues, and that's just the beginning of the list. There's plenty to talk about and plenty to work on.
That's right. That's just the last few days.
Yeah, right. That's last week.
Well, let's start with Iran. Yesterday morning, international negotiators, including the U.S., reached an historic agreement over Iran's nuclear program. Iran has agreed to essentially freeze its nuclear program for 6 months in exchange for an easing of some sanctions. You say you are cautiously optimistic about this agreement. Why?
Well, I think the first thing to say about it is, number one, it's not just the U.S. and Iran. This is the all five of the members of the U.N. Security Council plus Germany. A major negotiation. This has been the goal of U.S. diplomacy with Iran for years, is to try to get some serious negotiations going before they achieve the capability of building a weapon. So this is a breakthrough. On the other hand, it's not the breakthrough. It's preliminary. And I think it's also important to realize this is a step in a process. And the idea is slow down what they're doing now, ease off on the sanctions, not eliminate, but ease off on the sanctions, and have 6 months of serious negotiations that would indeed lead to the dismantling of this nuclear capability. I think it's a major step. You know, sanctions, we always talk about sanctions around the world. I remember they tried to use them against Saddam. It didn't have much effect. The sanctions against Iran are probably the toughest ever imposed anywhere in the world, and in part because they were bought into by not just us, but a lot of other countries. And it's really made a difference. I mean, they're really hurting in terms of their economy, and they've got new leadership. And this, the Rouhani, the new president's mission is to do something about their economy. And hopefully he sees, well, apparently he sees this as a, they're really asking themselves the fundamental question, is it worth it to develop a nuclear weapon given what it's costing our people? And this agreement indicates that they're recalibrating that decision.
As you well know, there has been a cavalcade of criticism ever since the deal was announced. Israel, one of our most important allies in the region, is unhappy. Benjamin Netanyahu has called this a mistake of historic proportions. How do we balance our interests in this region?
Well, you know, I'm concerned about Israel's reaction, but as I understand the agreement, and I haven't seen the details of it, nor do I have in privy, at least at this point, to intelligence data from Iran. But as I understand it, it is essentially a pause in their development, particularly with their enrichment of uranium and, in fact, a scaling back of some of their enrichment of uranium. And the concern, obviously, is that they're using this kind of deal to sort of slow down the West's scrutiny so that they can use that time to scramble and continue on their path to development. On the other hand, we've either got to talk or fight. And my understanding of this deal is that it's very limited in terms of what they get. And the thing about sanctions is you can dial them up or back on an hour's notice. So it's not like we're giving up anything permanent in this deal. We're saying you take a step, we take a step, and it's a trust-building relationship. Right now there's no trust. There's no reason we should trust Iran. But let's see how they do over the 6 months. And if they don't, then the sanctions can be ratcheted back up and, in fact, can be increased. So I see it as potentially a very positive development. Obviously, it's as John Kerry said, it's verify, verify, verify. We've got to be sure that they're actually doing what they say they're going to do. But, you know, people said a month or 6 weeks ago we could never get a deal on the getting rid of Assad's chemical weapons, and that seems to be actually happening. So I understand the criticism. I understand the concern. It is a delicate matter. But the alternative, if we do nothing, we say, okay, this is a bad deal. We do nothing. They're going hell-bent for an atomic weapon.
Well, you brought up Assad. That was going to be my next question. The last time you were here on Maine Calling, that was the big news. What to do about Syria? There had just been the decision to try out this deal that the Russians and Putin were helping negotiate. Now we've announced that, or the U.S. has announced that there will be new peace talks with Syria in January. How will not only what's happened over the last couple months with the dismantling of the chemical weapons, but also what's going on in Iran affect the prospects for peace in Syria's civil war?
Well, Iran, of course, is integrally involved in Syria. Iran is a patron of Assad and supplying troops and arms and money and everything else. So you can't untie those. And in fact, one of the reasons we have an interest in the Syria and what happens in Syria is because it could diminish Iran's influence in the region if Assad went. Syria is, and I spent a lot of time on it. I sort of landed in the middle of it when I was appointed to the Intelligence and Armed Services Committee, both of which are dealing with those issues. And last summer, I went to Jordan and Turkey with Carl Levin, the chair of the Armed Services Committee, solely to focus on the Syrian question. It's the single most complicated issue I think I've ever seen, with the possible exception of healthcare, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. But there are no good answers in Syria. But the fact that they're going to be continuing some negotiations, the only good outcome would involve A, getting rid of the chemical weapons, which seems to be underway, and B, some kind of negotiated transition settlement that gets rid of Assad but leaves a Syria that has some hope of stability. Otherwise, Syria starts to look like Afghanistan. It's a basing place for terrorists. Terrorists from all over the world are going there. It's a humanitarian disaster of just enormous proportions. We visited these refugee camps. It's heartbreaking to see these kids that look, you know, they look just like our kids, and there they are behind fences in these refugee camps, living in what amount to cargo containers and tents. Thousands, hundreds of thousands. The refugee camp in the western eastern Jordan is now the fourth largest city in Jordan, the camp. Some kind of negotiations, and the Russians and the Assad regime have to come to the conclusion that they're not going to win and that therefore some kind of negotiation is necessary. And hopefully what's being discussed for January will be a beginning of that process. But I got to tell you, getting rid of those chemical weapons was a huge deal, because we didn't want Assad to use them, but we also didn't want them to fall into the hands of some of the less desirable elements of the opposition. So that seems to be actually happening physically on the ground in Syria. That's good news. And it's a similar situation with the Iran nuclear capability. That's probably the number one priority of American foreign policy. And I don't know if this is a perfect deal, but if it's a small step and we can build trust and we can build additional restrictions, I think it's the way we've got to go.
Well, shifting from foreign affairs to domestic affairs, I want to talk about your vote on the, well, what your side is calling filibuster reform.
Mm-hmm.
I know that, Senator King, you're a student of Senate history, so I assume you did not take this vote lightly to change the very rules of the Senate. Tell me about your decision to vote for the so-called nuclear option.
Well, I think first let's say what it is. It limits the filibuster power with regard to presidential executive-level appointments and judges below the level of the Supreme Court. So it doesn't eliminate the filibuster for policy, whatever the issue is, which has been in place for many years. I think the first thing to say is that the filibuster is in no way, shape, or form in the Constitution. People that argue that this is some kind of ancient power that was put in the Constitution by the framers, that's just not true. In fact, in the 58th Federalist, Madison talks about the very idea of requiring a supermajority for legislation and concludes it's a bad idea. So they didn't include it in the Constitution. But here's the real problem. People say that the rules were changed last week. I would argue that the rules were not changed last week. The rules were changed 3 or 4 years ago, 5 years ago, by using them in ways that they'd never been used before. The best example is in the entire history of the United States, 23 Circuit Court of Appeals federal judges have been filibustered. 20 of those 23 have been since President Obama's been in office. That's not right. That's an abuse of the rules, in my opinion. The other figure is, in the whole history of the country, I think it's 168 executive nominees have been filibustered, 82 in the last 5 years. In other words, half in the entire history of the country. So what's really happened is a fundamental change in the way the rule has been used. You can have a rule, but if it's abused, then I think basically this change was brought about by the use of the minority, the overuse of the rule. It wasn't an easy decision, and it does shift things. But I'm very aware this is a rule that's going to apply both ways. There are going to be Republican presidents and Republican senates, and it's going to work both ways. They're going to be able to move their nominees. But see, I'm a former governor. I think the executive ought to be able to assemble their team and be held accountable for that team. Judges is a little bit of a close case, but this was really provoked by a continuing filibuster of candidates for the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and there was no pretense that any of these candidates were unqualified. It was all about a kind of ideological, we're going to keep Obama appointees off this court, and that's not the way this process is supposed to work.
How has all this affected your early optimism about prospects for bipartisanship in the Senate?
Well, that's a really good question. And, of course, a lot of the commentary has said that this decision last week is going to make it worse and make the partisanship work worse. And I think it probably will in some cases. But it was fascinating to me. We were on the floor. All the senators were on the floor. This was a big moment. And there were, you know, everybody was chatting and talking and everything. And what I noticed was that right after the vote, I had private conversations with 3 or 4 Republican senators. No rancor, no why did you do this, no you're going to pay, we're going to get you. It was sort of like, okay, now let's start talking about the budget. You know, they were moving on.
So there wasn't a concern that this would affect budget negotiations.
Well, there was a concern. And frankly, you know, I was a little concerned about the timing of this. And might it have been better to wait until after the budget negotiations were over? And I finally concluded, and by the way, it wasn't my decision, but I finally concluded that there was probably no good time.
Never a good time, yeah.
And there would be issues if you did it in January. We have the debt ceiling coming up in early February and those kinds of things. So it might affect those things. I mean, but I hope it does. And what I'm saying is among the rank and file, I didn't pick up the kind of, you know, this is war kind of language that I was concerned about. Now, you know, the leaders are going to say, oh, this is awful, and you know, this is the worst thing that's ever happened. I mean, the odd thing is if you go back to 2005 when the shoes were exactly on the other feet and Democrats were filibustering Bush's judicial nominees, it was the Republicans who invented this idea of the nuclear option. They didn't do it, but they almost did. But you can read the speeches of Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell, and they're absolutely the opposite. And they both just – and it's a question, you know, the old thing of whose ox is being gored, I guess.
Okay. And the other thing that's being discussed very much in the blogosphere is the potential for allowing cell phone conversations on airplanes. You fly pretty often. What's your opinion?
I haven't really thought about that. My inclination is no. I mean, if only because I look forward to a couple of hours where I don't have to do it.
I don't think you're alone.
I see it as a break. I think using, you know, your little devices to keep track of your email and text and stuff is okay. But, you know, I ride the bus a lot between Portland and Boston, and the bus has a rule. It has nothing to do with safety or anything else. It's for the convenience of the passengers. No cell phone, no discussions unless, you know, you're calling somebody to say, I'm going to be in 10 minutes and meet me. And everybody seems to live pretty well with that. It's just annoying to be sitting next to somebody who's, you know, doing all that. So I'm inclined to say let's leave the rule as it is just not for safety, but just because let's give ourselves a break.
For some civility.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. Stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN radio listener contributions and by The Clean Bedroom. Mattresses and bedding made from organic and all-natural materials in Kittery and now in Portland at 2 Portland Square, thecleanbedroom.com.
Intelligence Squared U.S., where the world's leading thinkers debate today's most critical issues.
Now, why is the Second Amendment necessary?
There's a basic human right to self-defense.
There is no rational basis for that prohibition.
The Second Amendment, as written, is anachronistic.
The next topic up for debate, has the constitutional right to bear arms outlived its usefulness?
Tune in for that Intelligence Squared debate this afternoon at 1 o'clock. Join MPBN on Facebook and over 10,000 friends of MPBN for notes about special programming and events, questions for you and from you about our television, radio, and online programming and services, conversations with other listeners who may not always have the same opinion as you, also schedule updates, information, news about MPBN. We invite you to become an MPBN Facebook friend and connect with other listeners and viewers. If you like MPBN on air, like us on Facebook too.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Senator Angus King. We would like you to join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to go straight to Steve in Rockport. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Senator King, Steve Morrow, debate teacher at UMA.
Uh-oh, I'm in trouble.
No, you're not. I remember a conversation we had a couple of years ago when you said the only power that you had as governor was asking the right questions in a divided Democratic and Republican split. How are you able to bring the power of the question to the Senate?
Well, that is a good question, Steve. And by the way, Steve is the guy who told me that I had exactly 17 minutes to speak to the graduates at Camden High School, and I told the state troopers to take care of him.
I was going to say 17 minutes.
If he tried to enforce that, but anyway, a lot of what I do is questioning, and what I've learned is that questioning is an essential part of these jobs because everything we learn is through, you know, public hearings. And witnesses, whether it's the Secretary of Defense or people from the, you know, about children's programs or Head Start or whatever. So a lot of it is trying to probe that data to really get at what the real information is. So I've learned that questioning is a big part of what I do, how I get good information. But if you just sit and it becomes at you passively, you're going to get conned. That's my experience.
Steve.
I believe it.
Thanks so much for your call. Going to go to Nasser in Auburn. Hi, Nasser. You're on Maine Calling.
Yes. Senator King, I am honored to be on radio speaking with you.
Thank you.
I am a member of the Baha'i faith from Iran. As you know, Baha'is are being severely persecuted in that country. I have followed the negotiations with Iran very closely, and I did not hear anything in the discussions about the human rights issue in Iran. And I think we in our foreign policy have always been short-sighted and have not looked into the long-term repercussions of our dealings. And this issue, I think, is one of them.
I appreciate your raising that, because right now, as you know, everything is overshadowed by the nuclear issue, and that's the number one consideration. But we try to work on human rights issues in other parts of the world with China and Russia. It's a very difficult issue, because it's hard for one country to impose its human rights values on another, even if it's a country that we don't agree with what they're doing. But it can, if we can ever get beyond, of course, you know, we haven't had any relationship with Iran for something like 34 years. And about anything, whether it's trade or foreign policy or defense policy or anything else. So this nuclear step is an opportunity to at least begin a dialogue with that country. But we've got to get the nuclear thing taken care of. A nuclear-armed Iran is a danger to America and to the entire world. So if we can get beyond that, then we can start talking about trade policy and other things that maybe we can have an influence over their internal human rights position. But I'm glad to have that question. I appreciate it.
Senator, may I ask another on the same line, ask this question. You know, how do we trust the Iranian government? We know that thousands of people, you know, either they're Baha'is or Christians or ethnic minorities or women or writers and all kinds of people behind bars, and they have all been branded spies of Israel or spies of America.
Yeah, I think the short answer is we don't trust them. That's why John Kerry said yesterday or day before that this preliminary first step agreement on slowing down the enrichment of uranium, it's verify, verify, verify. And Ronald Reagan's famous statement was trust but verify. And I think Kerry was very explicitly saying we're not even at the trust stage. So I agree with you. It's got to be – there have got to be international inspectors. There have got to be clear data. We've got to have a very vigorous oversight of this process, and otherwise, you know, we had similar negotiations with North Korea some years ago, and basically they didn't work, and North Korea went ahead to develop a nuclear weapon. So we can't let that happen again, and I think a lot of it is has to be insisting on international verification.
Nasser, do you still have family in Iran, and have you spoken with them, if you do, about this?
Most of my family members live in U.S. or Canada, so I do not have immediate family members in Iran, but I still am very much, you know, eager to know what's going on in Iran, especially because of minorities' rights in that country.
Mm-hmm. Well, a beginning, anyway, is the new leader that was just elected, who at least seems to be interested in doing something about the economy and is taking some steps on this nuclear thing. I mean, the challenge for him, I'm sure, you know, Iran has politics like every place else, and the challenge for him and for us is that I'm sure the hardliners in Iran have him on a short leash, and that's one of the reasons I've been concerned about imposing additional sanctions in the middle of this negotiation, because I don't want to give them an excuse to walk away from it. But it certainly is an important issue, and so I really appreciate hearing from you. Glad to have you here in Maine, by the way.
Nasser, thanks so much for calling in and adding your perspective. Going now to Greg in Presque Isle. Hi, Greg. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Hello, Senator, and thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
Sure.
I wanted to ask you a question about budget negotiations, if I could.
Yep.
In public seems, at least, that the Budget Negotiation Committee is only talking about basically two issues, entitlements and taxes. Don't you think it would be profitable to, you know, expand that viewpoint beyond that, considering the fact that we spend $92 billion a year on corporate welfare and only $59 billion on social welfare?
Well, that's where, when you say taxes, a lot of the discussion, and in fact the proposal that I put forth a couple of weeks ago, talked about focusing on corporate tax breaks, corporate loopholes, and in order to both lower corporate rates for the companies that are playing it straight and also providing additional funds to solve the sequester problem. So tax reform – but here's the problem, Greg. The tax reform is such a big subject that the budget negotiators are shying away from it because they sort of don't know where to start. On the good news is, though, that both the Ways and Means Committee in the House and the Finance Committee in the Senate are engaged in a serious look at the whole tax code and all of the loopholes and all of the deductions and all of the aberrations that make it unfair and cumbersome and expensive. So that's sort of a separate process. Now, I can't make any guarantees about where that's going to go or whether it's going to succeed, but I know that the two chairs of the committee in the House and the Senate really do want to do something about this. But the last time it was really looked at in a serious way was 1986, and it's past time that we should do it. In the context of the budget negotiations, I can tell you from what I heard late last week, what they're really looking at is a very small deal to solve at least part of the sequester problem for the next 2 years and allow us to actually pass a budget and allow the Appropriations Committee then to allocate the budget numbers in some rational way. That's not as large a deal as I was hoping for, but listen, in this, when we haven't passed a budget in 4 years in the Congress, just getting to that stage, I think, has to be viewed as progress. But I agree with you. The whole issue of the loopholes and what we call tax expenditures is something that really, really does need to be worked on.
Thank you, Greg, for your call. I'm going to go down to an email. This is from Jenny in South Portland. She says, what is Senator King's position on the Children and Families First Act? Like Senator King, we're also an adoptive family. Our extended family has both domestic and international adoption. The Children and Families First Act promotes family life for all children, the strengthening of birth families, and also includes helping children through adoption. Since this legislation is bipartisan, bicameral, and revenue neutral, don't hear that word very often, yeah. Is Senator King supporting it? Our extended family believes he should.
Jenny, thank you. I'm not familiar with the details of that particular piece of legislation, although I am a member of something called the Adoption Caucus in the Senate, along with Senator Landrieu from Louisiana, who is the sponsor of this bill. So I hate saying sometimes I don't know, but in this case I don't know enough to say that I'm prepared to co-sponsor, but I will certainly find out when I get back and see what exactly the bill would do. As you point out, adoption is something that's very important to Mary and I, and I think it's important to, you know, millions and millions of Americans. And if there are ways we can help support and make better that process, we certainly want to do so.
All right. Well, the phone number, 1-800-399-3566, email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Going to Todd in Bar Harbor. Hi, Todd.
Hello.
Go ahead. Do you have a question for Senator King?
Yes. I have a couple of comments concerning Iran and would be interested in his take on them. Seems to me that Iran has become our latest bogeyman, which we, of course, always looking for some reason to to get into wars and trouble. But my sense of the history is that since 1952, we've been messing with Iran. Seems like we want them isolated from the global community. We don't really want a, an agreement. And I think Iran has much more to fear from its neighbors and from us than we have to fear from them, I think.
Okay, Senator King, why do we fear Iran so much? Why is it such a big deal to U.S. interests?
Well, I think there are two reasons. One, the Iran hostage crisis back in 1979 and 80, I think, was a pretty traumatic event and created this estrangement between the two countries. But the big deal is the pursuit of a nuclear weapon. The prior president of Iran was a guy who went to the UN and said the Holocaust never happened and Israel should be wiped off the map. Well, if you've got people saying things like that who are obtaining the ability to do it and appear to have a willingness to do it, that's a serious concern. That's not an academic problem. And so the real focus has to be slowing down, stopping, and ultimately reversing their nuclear program. During the Cold War, there were two major nuclear powers, us and the Soviet Union, and there was a kind of unspoken rationale between the two countries, and we never had a nuclear war. We came very close at the Cuban Missile Crisis, closer than many of us realized at the time. But we avoided it. But as you have more and more countries have these weapons, and sometimes these are countries that are rogues, that aren't subject to the normal sort of rational rules of international conduct, boy, that's something to be worried about. I mean, as one of my colleagues said the other day, the people on September 11th killed 3,000 people. If they'd had the means, they would have killed 3 million. Wouldn't have made any difference to them. And so that's what really makes Iran and puts Iran in a different category right now is their active pursuit of a nuclear weapon.
All right. Well, thank you, Todd. And going to Peter in Freiburg. Peter, you also want to ask about Iran, right?
Yes, I do. Good afternoon, Senator. How are you?
I'm just fine, Peter. Thank you.
Great, great. Say, I'd like to thank you for your good works in this state ever since you're on Main Watch and now that you're in the Senate. I do have a question about Iran. The agreement in Geneva, I'm a big supporter of that. I think it's better to pursue negotiation rather than warfare. I'm concerned about Israel. They've spoken about the possibility of their striking Iran unilaterally to, as they see, you know, end the program, which I don't think it would do. I'd like to know what your thoughts are about that. And also, could you give me an idea of what our obligation to Israel would be if Iran were to strike back at Israel, given that? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, certainly Israel has consistently been our strongest ally in the region. It's a country that we've had a special relationship with since the day Harry Truman recognized Israel's existence in 1948. And so that's an important part. I mean, they're a democracy. They've been very supportive of us. It's an important part of our foreign policy. They have done unilateral strikes. They did one in Syria recently several years ago, to knock out a capacity that they viewed as a direct threat to them. They have to make those decisions based upon their national interest. In terms of an obligation, if they should strike Iran and then Iran should strike back, clearly I think we would be in some – we would have some commitment to defend Israel. On the other hand, if they were the ones that initiated the war, that would be something that we would have to weigh. I mean, we're very closely connected with Israel, but in the final analysis, it has to be our national interest that is at stake. But by and large, our national interest and Israel's are aligned. I've heard them make those comments about some kind of unilateral strike. I've also read and heard that they don't believe that they have the capacity to substantially set back the Iranian nuclear capability. I think it would be a terrible mistake myself because there's an old saying, if you're going to strike the king, you better kill him. And I'm afraid that a strike would simply accelerate their feeling that they had to do this in order to defend themselves. So that's why I think it's so important for us to try to de-escalate this potential nuclear confrontation. I'm just rereading Barbara Tuchman's The Guns of August about the beginning of World War I and realize how dangerous the world is and things unwind in ways that are absolutely unpredictable. And all of Europe and us ultimately found ourselves in a world war that nobody really intended or understood was coming.
All right. Well, Peter, thanks for your question. We're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN radio listener contributions and by VCharge Heat, providing sustainable thermal storage heating alternatives to oil, kerosene, or propane. More at goodcleanheat.com/MPBN.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a rising star in politics when he was crippled by polio at the age of 39. On the next Fresh Air, historian James Tobin says despite modern misconceptions, Roosevelt's polio was well known to the public and even became an important part of his personal narrative as he campaigned for the White House. Tobin's book is The Man He Became. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. Ongoing annual member support makes MPBN Radio possible. Your contribution to MPBN through your will or estate plan can also provide long-term support for programming. If you would like more information, talk to your financial advisor or contact Jennifer Foley at 207-330-4510. That number, 207-330-4510. Thank you for considering us. We'd be honored to share in your legacy.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today, we're hearing from our junior senator and former governor, Angus King. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We have a question from Philip via our Maine Calling Facebook page. The ACA appears to be a disaster at the moment, he writes. Could you comment on how we might fix this? Also, could you also comment on how we might get to a true single-payer universal health care system where everyone has affordable health care from cradle to grave, like Canada or other EU nations? What about placing everyone on Medicare? Thank you for your hard work.
And you have 30 seconds to answer this question.
I'll give you a minute.
I would differ with the question, if the premise of the question in one respect. He started out saying the ACA is a disaster. I think the implementation of the ACA is a disaster, and I distinguish between the concept and the implementation. I'm a firm believer, particularly after my experience in Augusta, that execution is as important as vision. You can have a great idea, but if it isn't implemented well or properly, it's going to be a mess, and that's what we're seeing now. These folks have just not done. I mean, to say they haven't done a very good job is an understatement. It's infuriating. I spent an hour and a half on the website the other night on the exchange trying to pick out my insurance. I got all the way through, and I think I'd put Mary's birthday in wrong. And in order to correct it, I had to start all over again.
It was
like buying something on Amazon in 1996. I mean, they figured this stuff out. So it's inexcusable the way that has happened. On the other hand, in states that have their own exchanges, it's working fairly well. In California, I understand that something like 10,000 people a day are enrolling. In Kentucky, it's almost 1,000 people a day. So I'm hoping that this is mostly a website problem. There are some underlying problems with the statute itself. Anything of this size is going to have problems in the implementation. Medicare Part D, the drug benefit, had these problems 5 or 6 years ago. Medicare itself. The government had to hire people to go door to door in the 60s to encourage seniors to sign up for Medicare because they didn't think they needed it, they didn't want it, they didn't understand it. So this is no surprise in one sense, but they could have done a much better job. I've gotten together with a small group of senators. We were just actually talking on Thursday afternoon about this to draw up a kind of Affordable Care Act Fix Act. To look at what are the provisions that aren't working, like this thing about people getting these cancellation letters.
Right.
That should have been fixed. Let them, if they have their policy, like the president said, let them keep them. That was a self-inflicted wound. It's not, it's a fairly large group, but in the context of the overall insurance market, it's not that large. Grandfather them. Let's take care of that. And let's look at other things that might be coming that are going to be regulatory problems. So I think there are things that can be fixed. The caller then goes on to ask about a single-payer system. I've done a lot of reading about various healthcare systems. None are perfect. Mary and I were camping last summer, and we spent some time with some family from Canada, and all they did was complain about their healthcare system, which we tend to idealize. And they're, you know, every system in the world has different good sides and bad sides. Ours is the biggest problem with our system is it's so expensive. We pay twice as much per capita as anybody else in the civilized world for healthcare, and the results aren't that good. And that's where we really need to be focusing, whether it's covered by Medicare or Medicaid, private insurance, fee-for-service. We're paying too much. And I was just this morning working on some data about, you know, how much we're paying too much and ways that we can fix that in part through the Medicare and Medicaid system. So I hope we can get the Affordable Care Act working. The idea of getting more people insurance, I think, is important. I don't understand why people are obsessed with saying people shouldn't have insurance. We want more people to have insurance. We just have to figure out how to make this thing work in a way that works for everyone. And we got to remember, Jennifer, there are millions of people who are now able to get health care coverage who could never get it before. There was a story just in the Portland paper last week about a guy, you know, had cancer 20 years ago. He could never get coverage. Now he can. That's a big deal. There are success stories out there, but you and I know that the negative always gets more press.
Let me follow up, though, with a big question. Why are we twice as expensive as other nations, and how do we fix that?
Well, there are a lot of answers to that. Time magazine did a massive study of that, and basically they said we're more expensive because we charge more. People charge more. Utilization is higher. We do more procedures. I think the fundamental reason is that our incentives are upside down. Our whole system is based on fee for service. If you're a doc, you get paid for doing something. If you counsel me to quit smoking and take an hour to do that and I quit smoking, it's going to save the medical system hundreds of thousands of dollars over the years, but you don't get paid for that. You only get paid for setting my broken finger. So we pay for procedures, and that's what we get. There's some new systems underway under the Affordable Care Act, interestingly, which may turn out to be the most important part of the bill. Here in Maine, pilot programs where groups of providers, hospitals and doctors, are being paid on a per capita basis for their patients and saying, okay, here's $8,000 a year, whatever it is, $9,000 a year, keep them well. So the incentive is to keep people out of the hospital, out of the emergency room, to get them to take their medications before it becomes an acute problem, to get them to deal with their diabetes. And we're seeing here in Maine 60 to 70% reduction in emergency room visits and hospital readmissions among this population. It's potentially just enormous. And that's why I think it's so expensive, because the way we pay for it is an incentive to do stuff, as opposed to keep us healthy. We're paying for sickness instead of health.
Okay. Going to a caller now. This is Hargrave in New Gloucester. Hi there. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, Governor King. Or excuse me, Senator King.
That's all right.
I'm glad you're back in Maine where you can recover from whatever's in the water now.
You bet.
But anyway, I have enjoyed the fact that you're an independent. It just thrills me that you're an independent in that Senate. And I guess my question is, you know, obviously things are dysfunctional. We all know that. How are you able to build alliances within the Senate to form what they used to call gangs of six or eight or whatever?
Yeah.
Is that growing? Is there a center movement growing, we hope? Is there anything like that going on?
Well, there is, actually. During the shutdown, Susan Collins, bless her heart, pulled together a group of 14, which is now 16, of people from both parties plus me. We had 7 Republicans, 6 Democrats, and me. And we worked up our own plan to solve the shutdown. And the fact that we were meeting, the fact that we were within hours of a press conference, Susan and I believe did put some pressure on the leaders to come to an agreement. And we've decided, that group, to stay together. We had dinner together just last week, as a matter of fact, and to tackle some additional issues, including the budget. So there is some of that going on. It's very hard. The institution pulls us apart. But what I found is, if you can pick your issues, you can find bipartisan support. The big issues like the budget are very hard because they go to the core values of the two parties. But last summer, for example, the Democrats had a student loan plan that failed. The Republicans had one that failed. And Joe Manchin and I, he's a senator from West Virginia, also a former governor, said this is ridiculous. And we opened some discussions with two or three members of two or three Republicans and came up with a compromise. And lo and behold, we got it through. It was a struggle, but we got it through the House and the Senate, and it was signed by the president. I went to the signing ceremony, and the president said, gee, could you do more of this? You know, because so little is going on. So on an issue like student loans, even immigration was done on a bipartisan basis in the Senate. So there are tender shoots of hope. But on the bigger issues, the ones that get all the publicity, it's very tough because you are talking about sort of, you know, basic Republicans, we're going to have no more revenues, no more taxes. And the Democrats say we're going to have no cuts to entitlements. And it's quasi-religious, and you can't get it solved. But there are other issues where you can. And the good news is I found a lot of virtually all senators want to work together. But this party structure really gets in the way.
Senator King, does your new group, your new block, have a name?
Susan calls it the Common Sense Caucus. But don't ever call it a gang. If you do that, she'll get you. She doesn't like gangs.
She doesn't like the gang appellation. Okay.
It's a group, as I say, of Republicans and Democrats, and I'm the odd man out. But I've got in my pocket, as a matter of fact, a list of a subgroup that wants to work together to find a budget solution.
All right. Thanks for your call, Hargrave. And going to Will in Bath. Hi, Will.
Hi, Sue. Hi. Senator King, I'm wondering, there's increasing evidence that we are stuck in a stagnant economy. I'm thinking particularly of Larry Summers' speech at the IMF a week and a half ago. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but the quasi-religious devotion to various positions seems increasingly divorced from economic good sense, and I'm wondering what your view of that is.
Well, clearly, I'm not familiar with Larry Summers' speech, but I'm certainly familiar with the fact that growth is stuck in the 1-2% range, and it's not. There have been some improvements in job growth just in the last couple of months, and we're hoping that persists. But we're not anywhere near full capacity in this economy. I'm on the budget committee, as I mentioned, and I hate it when people say I'm on the budget committee and I know everything. But anyway, that's caused me to really dig into this, and I'm sort of divided. The debt really is a problem. I was doodling with my calculator, and if interest rates go from 2% to 4%, which is not unexpected for Treasury bills, just servicing the national debt today would be $680 billion a year. And to put that in perspective, that's more than the entire defense budget and intelligence budget combined. And that's dead money. I mean, that doesn't buy any airplanes or Head Start slots or, you know, national park rangers or anything else. And that is a problem. I mean, it's going to crowd out – service on the debt is going to crowd out, you know, social programs and defense programs, whatever it is that you prefer. So we got to pay attention to that. On the other hand, we can't be so obsessed by it that we ignore the fact that the best way to cure the deficit is to have the economy growing. And if the economy grows, that's how the deficit goes down. The other thing a lot of people don't realize is the federal deficit has been reduced more in the last 2 years than in any 2 years since the Korean War. So we're really making some serious progress, and I think we should recognize that. not go crazy with overstimulation and that kind of thing, but I think some pro-growth jobs kind of programs, I think, make sense.
Will, you're going to get to be the last question. Thank you so much for calling in. Senator King, we're going to have you back. A lot more questions coming in.
Great. Great to be with you, Jennifer. Thanks for what you're doing.
Oh, well, thank you so much for joining us today. Angus King is Maine's junior senator. He serves on the Rules Committee, the Intelligence and Armed Services Committees, and the Budget Committee.
Two seconds. Anybody in Maine, anybody from Maine and Washington on a Wednesday morning, we have coffee at 9 o'clock, blueberry muffins. Come see us.
Okay. There we go. Today's program, produced by Jonathan Smith. Our volunteer Cindy Hahn answered your calls. John Keimel ran the board, and we had help from the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our podcast, by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. Tomorrow on the program, the computer guys are back to answer your tech questions and to share ideas on getting the best Black Friday deals. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.